Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
It's the Crossover Sports Illustrated's NBA Show. Breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your hosts, Chris Mannix, Rohan Akhmed, and Chris Herring.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast. I'm Chris Mannix, joined by Chris Herring and Rohan Akhmed. Chris is in New York, headed for what should be a, what do you think, tepid atmosphere at MSG tonight for Knicks Cavs. I have a few friends, Chris, that are Knicks fans. I'm not painting all Knicks fans with the same brush, but this one Knicks fan in particular is the most obnoxious fan I've ever met in my life. Like, my text chain with him is just like Julius and Brunson. Like, he just like reacts in real time to everything that's happening, not just in the playoffs, but every Knicks game ever. So I'm anticipating
you probably had
a
real quiet set of text messages from game two then, I'm guessing, because that was rough.
You know what's funny? I was sitting, and we don't need to go too deep into this, but I was in the Celtics locker room talking to Marcus Smart after their game two. And we're sitting there, and we have the Knicks game on against the Cavs in the background, and we see Randall go down. And I'm kind of sitting there, and I'm like, what the hell is Randall doing in the game at this point? And I heard Tibbs' explanation, like, he wanted to stay in and kind of get some rhythm. Like, no, you don't put your star player in the game down, what, like 18 or 20 with 3 minutes remaining. You get him the hell out of there. That was wild to see that.
It's not like we've ever seen a Tom Thibodeau star player get hurt in the end of a game that was probably already, you know,
he was on
cemented,
the bench. On the bench. He was standing right there too.
Yeah, a few feet from Tom Thibodeau. So that was, I've never seen so many fans in mass be like, Tibbs, what are you doing? So that could have been a lot worse than just the really, really ugly loss where
you've got a guy,
90 points.
You've got a guy coming off a fairly significant injury.
Yeah.
And he's still in the game down the stretch of a game that's hopeless. Like, That was insane. Well, we're going to talk about Knicks-Cavs, which is facing a critical Game 3 in New York later tonight. I want to talk about what we saw from Golden State-Sacramento. Golden State has a pulse, fellas. They have a pulse, and Draymond Green will be back in the mix for Game 4. But I want to start with, not so much the game between the Sixers and the Nets, because look, the Nets, this is what the Nets are, right? They're a pretty good defensive team with some pretty good players, but when you get down to it, in the fourth quarter of games, they have nobody that can take the ball and make a play. Kevin Durant is gone. Kyrie Irving is gone. I like Mikal Bridges. I like Spencer Dinwiddie. You know, to quote, to butcher the Austin Reeves quote, they're not him, right? Like, they're not the guy that's going to make a play at the end of a critical game. So, not shocked that even without James Harden, the Sixers were able to come back. But Rohan, this game was about standards, right? And exactly what are the standards in the NBA right now for flagrant fouls, for ejections, for contact of any time? In the first quarter, we had Nick Claxton scoring over Joel Embiid. Nick Claxton then does the Allen Iverson over Ty Lue, stepping over him to get to another spot on the floor. Joel Embiid reacts by kicking his leg vertically. And look, he didn't make contact with the groin, but that's just blind luck, really, that Joel Embiid didn't make contact with the groin of Nick Claxton. So that is called a flagrant foul one. Embiid is allowed to stay in the game. Heard a lot of people afterwards, players, coaches, whatever, believe that should have been a flagrant two. Fast forward a little bit to the third quarter, and you've got James Harden staring down Royce O'Neal. And look, James Harden has had his moments in his career, but the play that James Harden got called for was him trying, Royce O'Neal pressed up against him, and James Harden sort of trying to get around him, stuck an arm into his midsection. I saw that play probably 50 times. I don't believe for a second that James Harden was going for the groin on that play. I just don't. But the referees, whether it was a makeup call for Joel Embiid or just plain blowing it, they ejected James Harden from the game. So, Rohan, we'll start with you. What did you think of the plays in that Sixers game that were whistled? And does the NBA have a real problem here? Because Draymond, Embiid, and now you've got Harden. There doesn't seem to be any consistency with how things are called.
So I think the NBA, it's just short of a problem. They're going to get lucky because it's the first round, and Sixers Nets especially, it doesn't matter. But they got the Embiid call so wrong. I think they were rightfully killed by Shaq and Chuck at the halftime show. The fact that he missed the groin by happenstance, and the fact that Monty McCutcheon is going on TV and saying, oh, well, he missed it, so it was a joke. It sounded ludicrous in real time as it was happening. Everyone, at least anecdotally that I talked to, was talking to, thought he should have been ejected. And if I'm a Warriors fan, I'm incredibly upset that he wasn't ejected, because it feels like he had just as much intent to harm, if not more, than Draymond did in the Sabonis stomp. And it made no sense. Then you'll never convince me that the Harden call was not a makeup call. That felt like a textbook makeup call. It was the exact opposite of the Embiid play, where he shoves off with his arm literally every single time he has the ball, and has for the last 10 years of his career, whether he's driving to the hoop or trying to create space for a step back. To then say, oh, well, he made contact with the groin when clearly there didn't seem to be any intent. That was ridiculous. And let's not forget them also giving Nick Claxton his second technical for a stare down in the fourth quarter of what was a really important game for the Nets that they were winning at the time. I just thought the refs got every big call wrong. And if this was happening in the conference finals, I'd agree it's a much bigger problem. But it's, to me, especially embarrassing for the NBA when you have Joe Dumars kind of taking a media lap, which, how often does that happen? Like, when was the last time we heard from Joe Dumars? But clearly they felt the need to justify the Draymond suspension because everyone thought it was a bad idea. And then they come back and do this. If it continues, the league is going to have a credibility problem. And again, they're fortunate that Sixers and Nets is a lopsided series to begin with, but I thought these calls were ridiculous, and it made me frustrated.
You know, Herring, I want to get your take on it, but it's a little bit past the expiration date, really, of talking about the Draymond suspension. But the one question I would have asked Joe Dumars, because this clearly was a collaborative decision on the part of the NBA to suspend Draymond Green. That's why it came out just before midnight. And not the usual middle of the day release that the NBA puts out. The one question I've asked Joe, Joe, do you think that was worthy of a suspension? Because you're never going to convince me that Joe Dumars, bad boy Piston, believes that Draymond Green deserved a suspension for what he did to Domantas Sabonis. I also laughed at the idea that Sabonis's, quote, injury had anything to do with the decision. Like, listing Sabonis as questionable immediately after the announcement of the suspension came out was the ultimate troll by the Sacramento Kings. Mm-hmm. That was trolling 101. And it's ridiculous. Like, Sabonis was chest bumping teammates afterward. He didn't need an X-ray. He didn't need an MRI. He didn't need anything. There was no issue with him physically other than maybe a little bit of a bruise in the stomach or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I would just love to know if Joe Dumars really believed it, because I can't fathom that he did. But on the subject of Embiid and Harden, where do you come down?
I think I have the same view everyone else does. It looks like at best the calls were reversed. And essentially, you know, I think Rohan's point of view is logical there, that maybe one was a makeup for the other. Because Embiid, and I actually remember texting Rohan, and when I was at the gym, I was walking back from the gym after the game started, and I was like, I was just seeing the tweets of the video posted of what Embiid did, and I was like, he wasn't thrown out for that. It was a little surprising, but then to see that there are essentially two other ejections and both of them were, you know, lesser than what Embiid did, it was odd, the best way to put it. I want to go back to what you said about Dumars. Aside from the victory lap, he's done a little bit of media lately, which has been interesting. Jonathan Abrams, a really good writer from the New York Times, the author, he did a story on exactly this issue, which is like, how ironic is it kind of that Joe Dumars is the guy that decides punishments in the NBA? And the headline on the story even is NBA bad boy wants players to do as he says, not as his teams did. and it's like, so there's an irony to it. And Joe Dumars in the feature kind of explains that, well, it's good to have someone on the inside of this process that knows exactly what that stuff looks like. So it is interesting to see that, look, I'll admit that I feel like the stuff in the Philly Brooklyn game just felt like it was reversed or wrong, quite mm-hmm. frankly. The Draymond thing, I think there was always a chance for a suspension. I was a little bit surprised that they pulled that trigger. But, you know, I told you guys before, I was mostly okay with whatever they did. It felt like Draymond was inviting it to some extent. And it does feel like there's enough of a history there to make that argument. But, you know, I also understand where certain people are saying, like, this starts to feel personal at a certain mm-hmm. point when you're taking that step, because you're, you know, if more people are getting involved in the decision than normal, if you're waiting to hold the decision, if you're basing some of it on the way that Sacramento is framing whether Sabonis was injured or not, there were a lot of things at play that were weird about it. But I would agree with what Rohan said, that I think that coming up here, the league really has to be on their P's and Q's with these calls, because I don't think the Philly Brooklyn game really cut it. I was really thrown off by the fact that Embiid wasn't wasn't kicked out.
Look, I am always going to come down on the side of, if you don't have to eject or suspend a player, don't mm-hmm. do it. Now, maybe that does create something of a double standard for the postseason than in the regular season, but I don't care. I don't want to see the league influencing the outcome of these games when it's not absolutely necessary. And I don't think it was absolutely necessary to suspend Draymond. I certainly don't think it was absolutely necessary to throw James Harden out of the game. Whatever you can do to preserve the integrity of the game, even if it means allowing a little more physicality than you would during the regular season, I think you have to do it. I'm reminded of this quote that Joey Crawford gave to a fellow referee during one of those mic'd up moments years and years ago. He said to the referee, "Call what we see, not what we think we see." And I think that's got to be the mindset. Don't try to interpret intent. Don't try to interpret, whether or not something is excessive, which is a word we've heard a lot over the last, you know, couple of days. Just call what you see, and if you can, keep guys out there on the floor. All right.
Is there a difference, though, between that and what the refs do versus what the league does? Because I think most people can look at the Draymond
thing. I think the refs have their hands tied, though, sometimes with this stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I think they're told, like, if there's contact, like you heard Monty McCutcheon there, like Joel Embiid avoided contact with the groin, hence the call being what it is.
Sure.
I think maybe the solution is to, at least in the case of what happened in Philadelphia, Brooklyn, untie the hands of the referees to a degree.
Okay.
That's more my kind of take on that. All right, I want to talk about what we saw last night with Warriors and Kings. Rohan, if you had told me the outcome of game 3 would be Golden State minus Draymond minus Gary Payton II throttling Sacramento defensively and out rebounding the Kings with Kevon Looney grabbing 20 boards and dishing out 9 assists in that game, that would have been pretty far down on my anticipated outcomes of that game. What the hell did we see on Thursday night? Like, what was that between the Warriors and the Kings? Who, by the way, Sacramento, they're in a lot of trouble right now. There's heat right now on Sacramento. What did we see there?
God, so I thought the Warriors had a great chance to win this game without Draymond, just because the emotion of coming back home for game 3, the emotion of, I think, playing for him. Then once they lost Gary Payton II, I was like, oh, this is going to be tough. Yeah. I don't see how they do this. What lineups are they even going to play? This guy on Twitter, some random person on Twitter I was arguing with, was like, oh, the Warriors are going to have a real tough time replacing Draymond's 8 points and 4 rebounds. And I was like, if you think that's all he does, you don't know what you're talking about. Then, of course, Kevon Looney goes out there and looks like Hakeem Olajuwon on the boards. Sacramento, one thing about their offense in this series is they have not shot the three ball at any point so far during the series. Kevin Huerter, who I think has actually played really well otherwise, I think I like what he's done defensively. He's had other moments offensively that are good. It's just fallen apart. I think he's hit only 3 threes in this series. He's shooting an awful percentage from three. I thought defensively something Golden State did with much more intention in game 3 was just kind of taking away easy looks from Malik Monk. I thought they were a lot better about not letting him get to certain spots on the floor. In general, Golden State's been way better at defensively at home than on the road this year. I do think we have to start to... I think a lot of us coming into the series were not sure how much to weigh the Warriors' regular season against them. Was it just a veteran team not caring? Or could they really be this bad on the road? How much is Wiggins making a difference? We're seeing that split play out a little bit here in the playoffs. But I think a big kind of... At this point, I'm not sure if the Kings are due for a big shooting night or if their shooters are just a little nervous.
Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really avert your eyes for too much longer with how the Kings have shot the ball. I mean, I thought to me, when we're talking about just which team is better straight up and the reality of the Kings winning the series, if they were to win this series without ever shooting well, that's just a sign that they're not just a better team, but probably a much better team than Golden State at this time and space. That said, the first two games they managed to win, I think both games were relatively close. And the energy of that arena, maybe, you know, kind of that the mirrors were like objects might be closer than they appear or what have you. These teams are probably more evenly matched than what we realize. At a certain point, you start to wonder if maybe Golden State is doing something to influence the poor shooting. Also, this is, you know, you've got Keegan Murray, who just broke a record for threes made by a rookie in a season. He's really, really been rough. And it just kind of feels like at a certain point, particularly when you're on the road, certain guys have to make shots. Huerter's been rough. Keegan Murray's been rough. Those are the bulk of their three-point shots. Monk really had the first game of the series here where he really just didn't play well, was 1 of 9. None of that is going to get it done. You can imagine that the Warriors are going to play better at home offensively. They certainly had more spacing last night without Draymond, which is another factor. Mm-hmm. I think Wiggins, the more time you get under his belt, just be honest here, the quicker the Kings can end this, if they're actually going to win the series, it's much better for them to do that because you don't want Wiggins to really kind of get his full strength and like his feet under him. You don't want for these Jordan Poole all of a sudden to get hot at some point. He also has not played well in this series either. But I think not only did they have more spacing without Draymond, I think they had opportunities to put more speed on the floor too. Without he and Gary Payton, you're seeing Kuminga play. You're seeing Moody make a difference in this game. And you're seeing Kevon Looney just say, okay, Draymond's not here. I've got to do it by myself as far as the offensive rebounding is concerned, as far as the screening is concerned. And he played his tail off. And, you know, I didn't laugh when I got that call from Warriors PR imploring me to think about Kevon Looney for most improved player. But I kind of said to myself, like, okay, there's a difference between what Kevon Looney brings to the table and how he's improved compared to Larry Markkanen and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But what I will say is, like, he's so much more important than what he gets credit for. And I will say that whether he deserves an award for it or not, we can have that debate another time. But just, I mean, in some ways, his workhorse nature saved the season for them yesterday. I mean, obviously the game wasn't incredibly close, but just that effort shined through, got them extra shots, got them extra threes, and he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Most improved player is one of the weirdest awards to vote on, mostly because, like, people have very different criteria for it. Like, I was telling the guys of the Thunder, like, I can't vote for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. The reason he wasn't a superstar last year is guys shut him down. Like, he's
right.
He's played better, certainly. But
why I couldn't have Mun either.
And Lowry Markkanen played well last year with Cleveland. He took his game to a whole nother level. He was pretty easy.
Absolutely.
Vote at the top.
He was my vote too.
Yeah, top of that ballot. The Kings can't survive shooting 27% from three. Simple as that. They were, I think, a 37% three-point shooting team during the regular season. They are shooting in the high 20s right now. That can't continue. Not against a team like Golden State, which just blew the game pretty far open pretty early in game three, and certainly has the potential to do that again in game four. This is where, in game four and probably in game five, we're going to find out if the moment is too big for Sacramento, because I don't see any way they win game four. Like, Draymond's going to come back and he's going to be playing like a bat out of hell. Gary Payton, presumably over this illness, he's going to come back. He's a factor for them defensively. I don't see how they win game four. I know Sacramento is a good road team, but Golden State is a really good home team, and they're going to have some momentum with all the things, all the variables that are out there right now. And then we get to game five. That, to me, is high noon for the Sacramento Kings, because you know, Golden State is still a bad road team. Like, they are what they are. Like, that's not going to change. Can Sacramento deal with the pressure that comes in these types of situations when virtually nobody on that roster has felt that kind of pressure before? De'Aaron Fox, great clutch player of the year, whatever that means. Can he play at that level with this type of pressure? Sabonis, will the rim kind of shrink a little bit for some of these guys as the pressure increases? That's the variable for me. I would put.
Can I give my hot take for this series?
I would put every nickel I got that the Warriors win game four, and then game five will be everything. And I'm very curious to see how Sacramento responds.
I think whoever wins game four wins the rest of the series. Like, I think if the Kings pull it out, they go home for game five and win it. And I'm with you. I think the emotional boost of having Draymond back is going to be massive, but I do think the Kings can still win it. I think I think they had their wake-up call a little bit. Things were going a little sweet for them. They finally start to look a little shook. I do think they'll respond, but I think whoever wins game four just wins the rest of the series outright.
Okay. I'm curious. I mean, I brought up the point that...
It's a classic overreaction, but I'm sticking with it.
I just brought up the point that I think that having the floor spaced out a little bit more was a real boost for them. It you know, gives other people the opportunity to go off. So I'm curious about that. Also, I felt like they really loaded the hell up on Sabonis. And I mean, he turned the ball over six times. I think he had four assists. Mm-hmm. So that's normally a ratio you're not going to see from him. You can free that up and kind of space stuff out a little bit more if you're willing to knock down your shots. Not willing, but if you knock down shots, that's where Herter and Keegan Murray really, really become massive, where if you start to show that you're not going to make those shots, they're going to load up on Sabonis, and it basically turns into what last night was, which is Fox was the only guy getting them anything. You don't want the series to become that. You don't want these guys to run around feeling the confidence of just throwing four bodies at Sabonis, not to mention that Sabonis, even aside from just the Draymond thing, I mean, he's been banged up all year. The guy has had his one hand bandaged the whole year. So I've always worried about that as kind of an Achilles heel for the Sacramento team of just what if Sabonis gets hurt? What if he's not himself? Look, Alex Lynn has been wonderful and backup duty in this series. He's played more minutes in the series damn near than he did all season. But that's asking a lot of him, or even if you were to go to Shimezi Metu or anybody else, like, you can't put too much on Sabonis here. Someone else has to step up.
He's also a lot easier to attack defensively when they're not playing Draymond and Looney together.
Absolutely. No question about absolutely.
That. Yeah. All right, I want to talk about the Clippers and the Suns matchup. If you had Clippers down 2-1, Suns up 2-1 in this series, and if you had Russell Westbrook scoring 30 points and shooting 43% from three in game three on your bingo card, congratulations. That's pretty impressive.
He's been good, man.
He has, like, I remember thinking, it's not the same type of situation, but when Lance Stephenson left the Pacers, and it's like, Lance Stephenson should never leave the Pacers. Like, he should always play in Indiana. Like, Russell Westbrook is where he needs to be right now.
Yeah.
With the second LA team, where there's not as much pressure, no matter what the situation is, and with Ty Lue, who clearly gets through to him. Like, that, this is where Russell should be for the remainder of his playing career. But the Clippers, look, they're not going to win this series without Kawhi Leonard, obviously. We don't know the status of Kawhi. He seemed to be walking okay from the video I saw of the game the other night. But, he's that knee is just problematic for him. And always will be. I don't care if it's not directly related, as they say, to the previous injury, but still the same knee, still the same issues that he's been dealing with. Paul George, we know, is done for the remainder of the series. I have a hard time seeing the Clippers go on a run and winning. That being said, like, does this evoke a reaction from Steve Ballmer? Because Steve Ballmer is going to wind up paying north of $300 million for this Clippers team when you factor in salary and you factor in luxury tax payments. Now, that's basically a rounding error for Steve Ballmer, who's worth 90-some-odd billion dollars, but that's still a lot of money to not get anything more than a playoff appearance as a return. The George Kawhi era has been, let's put it bluntly, a failure to this point, in part due to injuries, but in part due to they haven't gotten the job done. Rohan, we'll start with you. Does this, like, it is the, if the end result of this season is a first round loss, does that mean it's time to start over with this Clippers team?
You know, I went on our podcast preview before the season when we had, all of us here, and I said that if they don't make the finals, it's going to be considered a failure.
I remember.
And it's tough because you see the team last night, even without Kawhi, without Paul George, scrapping, pushing the Suns rather to the limit. There was a huge non-call on Russ late in that game that maybe could have affected the outcome, where Devin Booker clearly takes a foul on him. The ref doesn't see it. You know, to me, I think the argument for splitting them up after this season is now they have to take into consideration this. This new second tax that the NBA is putting on teams limits the guys they can sign, limits what the Clippers can do in the trade market. Because, I mean, you look at their payroll, like, they have a ton of money committed already. They probably are not going to bring back Eric Gordon. On his contract, he's a non-guaranteed deal, but, I mean, Norman Powell's making $18 million. You still have Marcus Morris on an expiring deal, Robert Covington. I will say, I don't think that they need to blow it up. I think that they could probably make one more all-in move. Like I said, they have a lot of tradable contracts and players who I think would be attractive to teams. Batum, Covington, I mentioned Morris, Terrence Mann. It's just still too tantalizing what Kawhi and Paul George can do together. You know, Paul George, I think, generally has also been healthier. So this is kind of a tough blow for him to have this knee injury, the timing that he did. So if I'm them, I think I try to make one more. Can you maybe go out and put yourself in the conversation for Damian Lillard this summer?
No, you can't. You can't, because the draft picks aren't there. Like, they've dealt them. Yeah. They've moved them. They have.
You need. I mean, you need Dame to say. You need Dame to say, I want to play with the Clippers. And
even if
the
he did, like, what? Yeah. Like, one pick plus, you know, Marcus Morris plus Norman Powell. Like,
yeah, you're right.
Back. Like, what? Like, that doesn't. They have the contracts. You're right. To cobble together a deal. That would match the salary, but they just don't have the capital for it. They made their bed with this team.
Yeah, I think at this point, Kawhi and Paul George are both up in 2025. Even though I agree it's not been good enough, I think at this point you ride out the rest of their contracts and go from there. You know, there's other things to consider here. They're obviously trying to open up this new arena, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it would be great for them to go into that situation on a downswing.
That's a
especially
factor.
Considering
That's
they're
a
already
for sure.
Yeah, the second class citizen in the city. So I think you have to ride out the rest of their deals, but I'm with you. It's very disappointing, even though last night I find myself really impressed with them, and Ty Lue and Westbrook almost did it, but you know, I don't think it's time to blow it up just yet.
Am I the only one that feels like this is a little early to have this conversation? They're down 2-1. I mean, we just got done talking about how competitive a game it was without either of their two superstars. Kawhi, as Mannix was saying, was walking around like he may be able to play. They're saying it's day-to-day. I do totally get the concern that, like, look, what does day-to-day mean when he's missing a pivotal game in the series? Like, I understand that their track record here. Also, a couple years ago when he partially tore the ACL, they didn't ever give an update on, like, whether or not he'd done that. There were reports out that he'd done that, but they weren't confirming it. So I get the concern. I get the concern around this organization and the way that they phrase things. But, I mean, it's still within the realm of possibility that, you know, the next game they go out, whether Kawhi's there or not, that they tie the series. Phoenix has – this has been a more uphill battle than I think Phoenix expected, or at least than we expected for Phoenix, with them with Durant being undefeated up to this point with Durant. So we'll see. I think that there's a time and place to have that conversation. I think that they're as fascinating as any team in the league, really, as far as how much talent they have, but the reality that they just might not be able to get on the same page from a health standpoint all at once. As you were saying, Rohan, PG has been healthier, but when you
still
missed the play-in game last year, and which I think that was COVID, if I remember correctly, so it's not an injury, but between that and then this, and also the video that came out the other day of him working out on the court, like, he looks not that far away. So if they're able to somehow push through, whether it's Kawhi coming back or whatever else, to me, even if they made this a 7-game series, maybe he comes back and maybe he's there. But man, like, for the Clippers to actively say, like, look, we got to pull the plug here on the best talent they've ever had, aside from maybe the Lob City era, which was good talent as well. That would be so jarring to think about it, particularly because they finished as a 5 seed in a year where everybody was bunched up together without their guys being healthy all year, playing the whole year. So it's very tantalizing. The fact that they can go out and play Phoenix that close without either of their two superstars should be very tantalizing too, not to mention that Russ looks as good a fit as he has so far.
Regardless of what happens in this series, I don't think they have any choice but to run it back with these guys. I don't know what the trade value is for Kawhi Leonard at this stage with his contract. I don't know what the trade value is of Paul George. My issue is that I don't know how you could go into next season like believing that these guys can get to the finish line in one piece, like, because they haven't done it. We're now in what, year 4 of Kawhi and Paul George? Here's the number of games that Paul George has played over the last 4 years. 48 games in 1920, which obviously the shortened season with COVID and all that. 54 games in 2021. 31 games last season. 56 games this season, which would be the high for Paul George with the team. Like, he just gets hurt. It happens. And Kawhi Leonard is, you know, perpetually day-to-day and is always
Kawhi Leonard
should
maybe managed. Kawhi Leonard maybe like can't even play in the regular season anymore. Like, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, but
I mean, look, he was great. Like, you look at the numbers. Like, he was great in the second half of the season. Like, he quietly like was like the MVP of the second half. He was that
for
good.
Sure. My point is just anyone who complains about load management when it comes to Kawhi, we're seeing now why the team is so careful with him.
I really hate, like, I just briefly. I really hate. Like, I understand that we need to have takes on the idea of load management. It's obvious that certain teams use it when they don't, it wouldn't seem like they need to. I've said for years now that the conversation around Kawhi and the way he's managed has bothered me. And the fact that, remember, he sat out that season basically with San Antonio, and guys get reputations and they get really ugly treatment on the way out. The same thing essentially happened with Derrick Rose. And there were questions about, like, okay, the team is ruling you healthy, why can't you play? And frankly, it seems like, kind of sounds like that's kind of what was happening with the Pelicans this year, and Zion to some extent too, is that Zion basically said, look, technically I've essentially been cleared. They're basically clearing me. I don't feel right in my mind. And I watched it happen with Derrick Rose. He sat out a playoff series where he was essentially cleared. They cleared him late in that season, and he just said, I'm not mentally ready to come back. And then the minute he came back the next season, he got hurt, basically. And with Kawhi, we've watched him get hurt a number of times. We've watched him get hurt in the middle of a playoff series where they looked like they had a very real chance to go to the finals. And now we're watching a situation where, again, if you're day-to-day at this point in the middle of a series that is 1-1, you're probably pretty banged up. And we know that at this point that certain guys are more fragile. We've known that about Kawhi. It's not a surprise. I wish that people could step back, at least with certain people, and realize that like load management probably is very necessary for these guys. Maybe there is an argument to be made that letting them go at some point and just letting them try to play through and fight through. Some people have that opinion. I don't quite understand how at this point you could have that opinion about Kawhi, because it's just very clear that any step the guy takes could injure him, which sucks to say. He legitimately is one of the best players I've seen in my adult lifetime, just watching him in terms of the balance he has, as far as the one-on-one ability he has, the defense that he has. Toe-to-toe is the best guy I've ever seen guard LeBron James when he's at his best. He's that good and won a title on a new team. Like, how often do we see that as like a lone guy, a lone superstar? So I don't know. I hope he's back for this series. It's going to prompt questions if he's not. But hopefully certain people can at least ease up a little bit with the load management conversations around certain players, because it's very clear that they need to be load managed, in my opinion.
Around certain players, I would agree with you. I do think load management has spun out of control in the last couple
Absolutely.
Of years.
Absolutely. No doubt.
I mean, we just kind of killed Tom Thibodeau for, you know, playing Julius Randle, but Thibodeau, you know, you know, consistently gets beat up for the number of minutes he plays his guys. And, you know, we mentioned Paul George. Paul George on a podcast recently said, look, we got to practice more. Like, they got to put us through stuff more to keep our bodies kind of in tune with where they need to be, you know, during the season. I just think, you know, the solution to every physical ailment feels like it's become treatment and rest. And I don't necessarily think that's the right approach to take. Now, there's a lot of smart people on these NBA training staffs, dozens, in fact. Like, some of these teams have incredibly deep training staffs, a lot of them from Australia. And, you know, I just think that's an approach that isn't necessarily the right one to take, especially when you hear guys, players, the level of a Paul George saying, hey, man, we got to go up there and practice. I mean, look, I don't mean to go back to, like, the 80s and 90s, but, you know, you practiced all the time back then. You know, you went hard and practiced a lot back then.
Yeah.
Chris, you just wrote a book about it. Like, I mean, about the Knicks in the 1990s. And I mean, guys played a lot of games back then. Like, they didn't seem
Thibodeau
to have
was
an
on
issue.
Those staffs. Thibodeau was on those staffs. And, yeah. And I think there's something to be said for how old is the team that you're coaching. But my concern sometimes is not just about the injuries, but it's also about the output that you're going to get at this time of year. Like, the last time the Knicks were in the playoffs before this, they just did not have another level to go to against the Hawks. And
that was talent, though, right? Like, that was more about they just didn't have like Randle was boxed in with some of the most rudimentary defense you could ever see.
Well, we watched that sometimes with Thibodeau's teams with Chicago. Now, granted, it was mostly injuries, which you could make the argument is that does that have something to do with the way he's playing the guys? I think it's an interesting conversation to be having on a day where Nick Nurse was let go by the Raptors, of the fact that he has been quietly like the most aggressive coach about playing his guys more minutes than everybody else, with Siakam and Fred VanVleet not necessarily resulting in as many injuries, certainly this year, but just guys, you know, seemingly a lot of players maybe not seeing eye to eye with him after a certain point, him certainly having blowups with certain players. And I
Which
wonder
happens.
To some extent.
It happens when
it does.
I saw Brad Stevens, who I still think is a great NBA coach, you know, lose the locker room a bit, not in a negative way, but didn't have the same, probably didn't have the same guys listening the same way they did early on in his career.
It's going to be
probably
a challenge.
The same thing with Nurse.
I will say this about Nick Nurse as it relates to that. as he's rumored for the Rockets job. It'll be interesting to see what happens because, one, it's very different.
There's a fun job. Why in the world does Nick Nurse want the Rockets job?
Because
he's going to get paid $8 million next year. Like, go to beach,
do something
else.
Seriously.
He has the ties to the organization because of the time from before, but I wonder to some extent.
He's going to have his pick of jobs.
I wonder whether that's a job that he should walk into, just what? Beyond the fact that he was having the clashes
I
with
tell
certain
you what,
players.
You know what you're
what
doing,
if the Clippers
though?
Job
yeah,
opens
what you're doing, though, is you're crossing your fingers and hoping Victor Wembanyama winds up in your locker room. Like, that's the only real reason
anymore.
To take – but that's the only real reason to take it, right? Like, why would Frank Vogel want that job? Like, to me, that's a job you're going to get fired for if you don't get Wembanyama. If you get him – game changer. All of a sudden, you're Scott Brooks from Oklahoma City on the rise there with those.
I would legit wait until after the lottery. Yeah,
no, I'm not doing the Harden thing. I can't handle the Harden thing. If they sign James Harden, honest to God, if they sign James Harden, that team should be stripped away from Tillman Fertitta and everybody in the front office should go. Like, that would be the most insane signing in the history of the NBA.
We've seen it rumored more. I saw it rumored yesterday. It would be such a weird move to do that,
he's
though, because the team's not there.
We did this. Like, he would be, like, what, 33, 34? You'd have to give him a four-year contract that pushes him to 38 at max dollars. Like, there's a reason he likes Houston. He likes the city. Like, he likes kind of the way that his life, he's being
treated
out there.
He likes a lot of things.
Yeah.
I can't with the Harden and Houston stuff. I'm telling you. Going to be, if they sign... James Harden, I'm going to be apoplectic on this
when that
podcast.
Happens.
I'm going to be apoplectic
if
they do that. It would be wild.
I just don't know why Nick Nurse would want that job. He should wait to see what happens with the Clippers. Also, Ime Udoka might go to the Raptors. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Ime Udoka's going to get a job this cycle. It's happening.
Right.
You know, the Nets only didn't hire him because of the Kyrie stuff. Teams out there are on board. They mm-hmm. have researched the situation with him. They're comfortable with bringing him in. Whether it's Toronto or anywhere else, Houston in the mix, he's going to get another job. All right, last thing, while we're on New York. This is going to be a fun game. I'm envious of you, Chris, being over there at the Garden tonight because it's going to be wild and a little bit unpredictable, right? Like, I'm not sure how the young Cavs will react in that type of environment, their first road game in the playoffs. We saw their first home game in the playoffs was a disaster. Nobody showed up for that. But then in game two, they got their act together. Darius Garland looked infinitely more comfortable in that second game. Man. And they also figured out something that Mavericks people were telling me for months. Jalen Brunson is attackable. Like, the Mavericks have always told me, people down there, that when everybody brings up how you have to kind of hide Luka Doncic on defense, they're like, no. We had to hide Jalen Brunson more on defense. And Cleveland has kind of realized that in this series. And our friend Michael Pina wrote a great piece over at The Ringer where he kind of put numbers to what we see with our eyes, where the Cavs were scoring at an elevated level when they put Jalen Brunson in some actions. That's going to be an interesting coaching twist because, Chris, there's not a lot of places you can hide Jalen Brunson against this team. I guess theoretically you could put him on Okoro, but... it's a pretty big physical mismatch.
I mean, Okoro was out of the game. I thought that was a huge difference.
But that was what one of the interesting things was, and it's actually one of the things I'm really intrigued by, is that I think the Cavs, I don't think J.B. Bickerstaff needs to be convinced of going against the idea of playing Okoro at this point because frankly, if you're out there and you've got LeVert playing, which LeVert was terrible in game one, he was fantastic in game two.
He got his defensive legs effort. These guys got their legs under them in game
two. Oh, yeah, and you can attack Brunson with LeVert, whereas with Okoro, you can't really do that. And so, at some level, it feels a lot like what we were just saying about the Kings-Warriors series, where it's like, oh, when you've got this one guy out, I mean, Okoro, granted, he's not Draymond defensively, but you're looking for some of those things from him, just the physicality, the height, the size, the perceptiveness of, like, what to do defensively. But he's not spacing the floor. He's taken four shots in the playoffs so far from three. All four of them, I think, were wide open. He missed all four of them. Mm-hmm. And then he had two fouls within the first 3 minutes of the game in game two. Never got back in. And so that's what I'm saying is, like, I think Bickerstaff maybe has made up his mind there of, like, let's just roll with LeVert and see what happens. If he's not playing well, then so be it. But LeVert played really well defensively the other night. He was up high on these traps and these double teams and everything else, forcing the ball out of guys' hands, or in some cases not the Knicks not moving the ball, which was worse. But they really settled in defensively. I think that the Knicks were somehow, and I don't know how this was the case. I guess they're still a relatively young team for some guys. They were not prepared at all for the physicality that Cleveland bought. And you could tell that Cleveland, like maybe like Mannix mentioned, from me having done the book on the 90s Knicks, reading the day-to-day clips that I had to read thousands of them for that book, during the playoff series, you could always tell when a team was going to hit back physically. And the Cavs were saying all those things in their media stuff. Now, granted, they were also complaining a little bit about how physical the Knicks were in game one. But a day or two after that, they were like, we've got to match the physicality. And they came out swinging. The Knicks were so not physical. I'm sitting there watching Mitchell Robinson set rub screens where he's not even rubbing people. And because of it, you're watching Brunson get trapped and caught in a corner where he's got nowhere to go with the ball. You're watching Randall try to do it by himself and losing the ball. He had something similar to that Sabonis stat where he had like six turnovers or whatever it was. That's not going to get it done. You've got to move the ball. You've got great role guys that shot the ball very well, with the exception of, I would say, Barrett, who shot the ball poorly for most of the second half.
Yeah, you don't, in a series like this, you don't need Isaac Okoro's defense as much as you need Caris LeVert's offense. Like, RJ Barrett, there's something wrong with RJ Barrett. Like, I was watching, like, he's shooting. Take a close look at this during some of these games. He's shooting with his hand in front of his eye. Like, he's got one of those, you know, screwed up jump shots right now where he's blocking his own line of sight. Like, that needs to be corrected in the offseason. But for now, his shot's just broken at this point. He's 4-for-13 in game two, 0-for-3 from three-point range. You don't really have to worry about Quentin Grimes beating you, you know, from the perimeter. I guess Hart can be effective at times. He's going to be healthier and quickly, obviously, is a great player. But you don't need Okoro to be like a wing stopper. Like, maybe you'd need him in a series against Boston or a series against, you know, Milwaukee even with Chris Middleton. So
can I just give a quick LeVert stat?
Oh, I thought you were going to get another hot take there.
No. So
whoever wins game three wins the series.
Yeah. I wrote about this earlier this week. LeVert played only 9 minutes with Mitchell and Garland in game one. He played 22 minutes with them in game two. In those 22 minutes, the Cavs outscored the Knicks by 32 points and shot 59% from three. It's easier to attack Brunson also with Garland and Mitchell when LeVert is in the game.
And look,
going back to the original point of this conversation, you mentioned there's nowhere for him to hide. They tried to trap Garland on some of these ball screens. When LeVert is an outlet instead of Okoro, it makes such a huge difference for their offense. I think he has to play way more in this series.
And look, you attack Brunson defensively, you're going to impact him offensively. You're going to wear him down. Like, he shot 1-for-8 from three-point range. Like, some of that has to do with the fact that the Cavs were hunting him through this series. I guess my biggest question coming into game three is, do the Cavs pucker up a little bit? Like, are they, you know, it's going to be a wild scene there. You know, that crowd has been desperate for a Knicks team that's any good. This is a better version of the Knicks team from 2 years ago. This is a series that is eminently winnable. It's going to be wild. And do we get the same type of performance from LeVert, from Darius Garland, from Evan Mobley, from these young guys that have never experienced something like that before? But if they're not intimidated, I believe coming in, they were the better team. Not just because they were the better seed, but I thought they were the better, more complete team. And they showed it in game two. I think game two is much more of a reflection of where these two teams are talent-wise than game one was. And now they've kind of figured out this Brunson stuff. You know, it's going to be a chess match. Like, how does Tibbs respond to the hunting of Jalen Brunson? Does he have a counter move? Does somebody else play a little bit more? Does he change the matchups up a little bit? Does he change his defense up a little bit? I think that's going to be really interesting to watch in this next game. So,
yeah, I'm excited for it. It's a situation where you would imagine the Knicks are going to punch back. They're going to be at home to some extent. And I remember saying this the last time the Knicks were in the playoffs. They can't keep shooting this poorly. Like, you know, that was what I said last time. And then Randall shot less than 30%. I don't think that they'll continue to be this poor, particularly the role guys. But then again, this was such an ISO-heavy team throughout the season with Brunson, with Randall, that, you know, and this was what I wrote at the end of the season about Randall when he was out for those basically like that last week of the season, I wondered if it could kind of be a blessing in disguise for the Knicks just so that you could get other guys involved so that they would have the confidence, the rhythm to kind of feel free here. And we saw a little bit of it with Hart in game one, but you need more out of Quickly, particularly. You need more out of Barrett. You would like to see Grimes kind of step up here and there the way that they did when Randall was out, and you just haven't seen much of it. Total credit to the Cavs. Also, you mentioned him once, but we haven't said much else about it. Garland was exquisite in game two. I mean, he was just fantastic. 30-foot threes. I mean, he, you know, it's not a new
way concept, more aggressive.
But he looked like Lillard a lot in that game two. And I mean, if he's that good, you don't even need Mitchell to be, you know, the 50-point bubble scorer necessarily. I mean, he's just there.
Let me tell you though, Donovan Mitchell coming into this game. I know Donovan pretty well. I think this is going to be as amped up as he's ever been. Like, to be back in New York.
Probably.
Against the team that wouldn't give up enough to trade for him. Like, in front of that MSG crowd, I think he's going to be fired up for this one. Chris, we'll let you get over to the game. Rohan, we'll let you, whatever you're doing in that basement. I don't know what's happening.
I thought we had made it through a whole pile where he wasn't going to get you.
I still don't know.
I got a lot of Dwayne Wade highlights to catch up on.
Ah, so, good. You know, I'm looking forward to that Hall of Fame piece in a couple of months.
I got something for you before then, Chris. Don't worry.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.